Not long ago, there were only three television channels, and the cheaply made family man comedy was king. Turning the dial would only give you another glimpse into a suburban nuclear family with a breadwinner husband, a stay-at-home wife, and the occasional talking horse. That is until 1964, when one show dared to take a glimpse into the lives of terrible monsters that lived next door. The Munsters premiered that September, and well, America has yet to recover. The Munster Hunter shuns the millions of hours of original shows that are available at the press of a button to take a look back at a 60-year-old comedy about a Frankenstein monster and his grotesque family.
He reaches down and he just grabs her by the butt and lifts her up.
Yep. Yeah. Instead of opening the window, he punches through the window. Which, I mean, this is your damn window, man.
By the way, he's trying to catch the raven out of the clock.
Oh, is that what he's doing to feed the cat?
Yeah.
I was very disinterested, to be honest. The Munster Hunters, available every Monday wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Mouse.
I'm Weens.
We have the Mouse and Weens podcast. I'm the mom that lives in suburbia with three kids.
I'm alone.
She's the hot Hollywood
cat lady.
And we have a fun podcast where we talk about life, love, and
loneliness.
Pubic hair. Come on.
I'm sorry.
We hope you come take a listen to us. We're on all the platforms, and we will see you soon.
I have PMS.
Hello and welcome to the Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I am Phil Rude. I'm the dad.
I'm Austin Rude, and I'm the son. And I'm Kevin. I'm Austin's stunt double. Sorry, that was a really lame joke, but anyway.
I was trying to be like that guy who was interviewing them, like the totally forced laughter. I like that. That was good.
Yeah.
That was a good, yeah.
Should have workshopped it a little more.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I'm no voice actor,
okay? I like
okay?
where you were coming from, yeah.
There we go. Anyway, we watch movies on this podcast, and we talk about them sometimes.
Sometimes it's our stunt doubles.
Yes, that's right. And we're never going to tell you which is which.
When we talk about, like, controversial topics. Like, uh-oh, we're starting to get into race. Bring in Cliff.
That was Kevin. Sorry.
If I ever
have a take that's really out of left field.
It's Kevin.
Yeah. And I'm sure to anger people with discussions about this movie, but...
No. We're going to get to it. This week, let's get right into it. This week, following up Babylon, we went with another epic period piece, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This 2019 love letter to Los Angeles follows B-level actor and his stunt double as they attempt to find success among a changing landscape of movies and TV as they cross paths with the end of their era. This film stars Leonardo DiCaprio as Rick Dalton, Brad Pitt as Cliff Booth, Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate, and Emile Hirsch as Jay Sebring, along with Timothy Oliphant, Dakota Fanning, Bruce Dern, Austin Butler, Al Pacino, and Mike Moe as Bruce Lee. This movie is written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, our second Tarantino this season.
That's right, I think.
Yeah.
Is it third overall?
Third, if we are counting True Romance.
Right.
Which he scripted but did not direct. Which it is very much. I think just the script of that movie is super Tarantino.
It's got his trademarks in there.
It's not directed in his style, but it's hard for me to not look at that as a Tarantino movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm gonna put the mattress down for you to fall on, so it's a softer blow. This is not my favorite Tarantino movie. It's not top tier Quentin Tarantino for me. I feel like this is his most personal movie, and I feel like a lot of people who live in LA, who work in that industry, love this movie. It's a little too inside baseball for me, but I find it... I still like the movie. It's just not something I put up on the tier with, like, Jackie Brown in Inglourious Basterds and his westerns. You know what I mean? So, I know, let's rip the Band-Aid off. You don't like this movie. You didn't enjoy watching this, and I want to tell everybody, shut the fuck up. I feel bad for making you watch it. I thought you
don't
would,
feel bad.
I thought you would enjoy it more than you did, but I feel like you kind of you go on about your thoughts on this movie.
I did not hate this movie.
Okay.
I just don't think it qualifies as a movie. I think it did a bad job at being a movie. And I'll get into that later. But I didn't connect to this at all. And I feel like it's because it was made for a very specific audience that needed to know a lot of things going into it. And I did not know those things. And so I was confused.
What kind of things did you...
Like the Manson family.
Okay.
That was never explained. Frankly, Sharon Tate could be removed from this movie entirely. And that would not affect the plot.
Sharon Tate, you're right.
She's a waste of screen time in this. I get it.
She's kind of the red herring of this movie. Like, oh, if you know about the Manson family and you know who Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski are, now we know Roman Polanski for different reasons. Mm. But if you understand that history and that specific story, then the whole movie, you spend waiting for Sharon Tate to get murdered. And for everybody in that house to get murdered, honestly. But
right. That's the whole thing is this movie, the only actual plot line is this dramatic irony of understanding what is supposed to happen to these people and then figuring out that this is a alternate history / revenge fantasy. I'll get into that later.
Sure.
Because I don't like that either, but I don't know, like, it didn't, I expected to learn about the Manson family and be introduced to those characters, and I wasn't.
Okay.
It was confusing.
Okay.
It was really confusing. And then, there's the main characters, Rick Dalton and, Cliff Booth.
Right.
Who, they're interesting for sure. And we spend, you know, the majority of the movie with them. But there's no plot, really. There's no character change. There's no real...
I will agree with you on the idea that there is no character change. Because Rick Dalton is the main focus of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And... We are watching, it's a character study of someone who is dealing with facing the end of his career, of being washed up, being a has-been, and kind of being self-destructive about it. But you're right, he doesn't, kind of turn that it takes is at the end when we're sort of like, oh, and then he met, got in good with his neighbors and presumably met Roman Polanski and went on and had a, people have said this is based on Burt Reynolds, that Burt Reynolds was sort of a B-level movie star, him and his stunt double, and then, you know, at a certain point took off and became like the biggest movie stars in the world. I look at this more of like a Clint Eastwood parallel, because Clint Eastwood started in like TV westerns and then went and did the Italian westerns and actually became a huge star off of doing those.
The Clint Eastwood is who I was thinking of during this movie.
I think that's a much better parallel if you're looking at the career trajectory of Rick Dalton. Mm-hmm. Attached to a real life person. But my problem with Rick Dalton is that I think Leonardo DiCaprio is only a good actor if he is cast in the right role. And I don't think this is the right role. I don't particularly like him in this movie. Not that I don't like his character, which I don't, but I don't think DiCaprio's playing him real well. I think his weird southern drawl is cartoonish and silly and doesn't sound convincing. And I just kind of don't buy that he's as down on himself as he is. And I'm not saying DiCaprio is not a good actor. In some movies, I think he's great. I love The Departed. I love Catch Me If You Can is actually a really fun movie. The Revenant, stuff like that. I think DiCaprio has been really good, but I think like this, I think his real early stuff, like Titanic, I don't think he's well cast in Titanic at all. That is an unpopular opinion, but I did not think DiCaprio was a good actor until he was past that phase where his voice was pitched. He always came off as like a 12-year-old kid, and I have a lot of problems with Titanic, but I don't like him so much in this movie. For me, the fun of following them is Cliff, and I think Brad Pitt is Cliff Booth.
Oh, Cliff is great.
And the more I watch it, the more I realize Cliff is what I watch this movie for. Every favorite part of mine is centered around Cliff Booth when he goes to Spahn Ranch. Mm-hmm. When he's fighting Bruce Lee, when he fights the Manson family at the end, I think he is probably my favorite Brad Pitt character of all time. I think he's so much fun, and he's such a, I think that's a character with a lot of depth and a lot of interesting attributes to him.
Cliff is a lot. He's a much more interesting character.
Yeah.
Again, disappointed that he doesn't really... There's no arc for him, though. He's kind of stays the same throughout.
He does stay the same, for sure.
I will say, I mean, I personally bought Leonardo DiCaprio's performance in this. I just hated his character, because, like, comparing it to Babylon, Brad Pitt's character in Babylon goes through a similar arc, except I feel bad for Brad Pitt in Babylon, because he's very much like this actor who wants to be something and change the art. He cares about it.
Right.
Here, whatever his name is.
Rick Dalton.
Rick Dalton. He's just an asshole. Like,
he's an entitled crybaby.
He's undisciplined. Yeah. That 8-year-old girl... You know, as pretentious as she is.
Precocious child alert. Precocious child alert. Yeah.
She cares more about acting than he does.
Right.
And, like, she practices, studies.
Yes.
He doesn't care. He just kind of doesn't want to say goodbye to his career yet. And that makes me kind of hate him even more. And then there's the scene where, like, I don't know, he figures out what his role in that one movie is supposed to be, and, like, he plays it really well, he kind of redeems himself, but there was no real change, there was no, like, lead up to that, other than him screaming at himself in his trailer, which was a funny scene.
Yeah.
but, like, you get the impression he's like, I'm not gonna drink again, I'm not, why couldn't you stop at 4? Why'd you have to do 8? Whatever. But, like, I don't know. I don't get the sense that he learned or earned that kind of reward that he gets of, oh, okay, I pulled it off and everyone's proud of me.
He doesn't, because, like, even after that is when he goes to Italy to make movies, like, which he's seeing as defeat. Like, he doesn't get a career from doing this one good TV spot.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, but he's just sort of like... I don't know. I feel like that whole section where we're watching him film on set, I feel like that entire thing is just Quentin Tarantino wanted to direct a episode of 60s Western TV.
Yes.
Like, that's all that is. Is that he wanted it to do an episode of Lancer.
That's exactly what I was thinking when watching it. And that's fine. but connect it with some plot.
Right.
You know, don't just have it.
It's the part of the movie that drags the most. This movie doesn't need to be 3 hours to tell this story. You're talking about Sharon Tate being a waste of screen time. I at least have fun watching Margot Robbie playing Sharon Tate. Dancing at the Playboy Mansion, running around town, shopping, going to see herself in a movie. Like, that is at least interesting and endearing. And if you're going to go with the red herring plot of that, that's what you want. You want people to lean in and care about Sharon Tate as a person, as opposed to an actor who didn't really get a chance to take off and sort of a footnote of this horrific murder spree that happened right in L.A. So...
Jeez.
Just leave it open. He can come and go. So, yeah, for me, the TV Western stuff was... Like, it would have been cool to see him, like, when the director comes in and is telling him, like, oh, we're going to put you in a big mustache and a wig and this crazy coat, and we're going to make you unrecognizable, you know, like, and have it be like, this is about the acting, not about you, the celebrity. And, you know, to show stuff like that, I thought was interesting, but, like, we didn't need to watch the whole, like, Timothy Oliphant coming into town and shooting the guy behind his back and doing all the, you know, all the lead, they're like showing the whole episode, and I'm just like, okay, like, this is just Tarantino being self-indulgent.
It's very unnecessary, but again, it's like, this is what I feel about this movie, is I don't like the way it's structured, and I kind of don't think it has a point to any of what it's trying to say, and for that point, that's what I mean when I say it's not a movie, is it's just a collection of scenes, but all of those scenes are really well done on their own. It's just they don't fit together in a way that
we said a
tells
similar thing about
anything.
Babylon, that it wasn't that the scenes didn't fit together, it's that they didn't flow together, and every scene in Babylon felt like its own standalone thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but Babylon still has like a plot in a way. Like I just don't feel like this movie has any of that.
I think,
like,
this does as well, but I think you're on the right track about needing to know something about the time and place that it's taking place in. It's it's the end of the 60s. It's right at or very close to the end of the Hays Code, which means a whole new era of movies is coming in. The new Hollywood era.
Right.
Where darker endings and sort of more experimental kind of things. It may have started to be happening around. This is 1969. And it's also the Manson family. And what the Manson family did is it kind of ended the whole hippie movement. Because they were hippies. And
suddenly it's bad,
like,
to be a hippie.
It was like, oh yeah, being out in the desert taking acid, it's cool for a while, but then it goes too far. And it's just sort of like, I think I was trying to think of, like, what's a modern comparison to, you know, like, the innocence of the 60s died when the Manson family went on a murder spree. And sort of, like, it sort of washed out what the hippies were all about. And I think the most modern comparison is, like, the Black Lives Matter movement when, like, people gave money to that and then they turn around and, like, bought real estate with it and things like, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, yeah, like a movement, like, gets hijacked.
The movement gets hijacked by some sort awful of, like, yeah, something, a terrible element of it that makes the entire thing just sort of disingenuous. It doesn't mean that, like, it didn't start out as a good thing, but it just sort of like, oh, okay. We thought we were going to do something good here, but instead darker forces took over. And I'm right, just trying to, maybe that's not the best comparison, but
I get what you're going,
you know what
for,
I mean?
Though.
Like, when something becomes organized or semi-organized, like the Manson family, I'm trying, my shout out will be more geared towards if you want to learn about the Manson family.
Well, that's just what I thought this movie was going to be. Sure. And I'm so disappointed.
Well, that's...
Because I went into this knowing virtually nothing. I told you, I thought this was about a completely different cult case. The guy who poisoned everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I expected this movie to be. And then, like, it wasn't any of that. It was just all about other stuff, and it was weird.
That's there's a Tarantino thing that happens when he's working on a movie, and then people are like, well, what's this movie about? And, like, when this one was starting production, he's like, oh, Tarantino's making a movie about the Manson family. And it's not really about the Manson family. In the same way that Inglourious Basterds isn't really about this commando unit. It's about a survivor of genocide, you know, taking revenge.
Right.
And Kill Bill, people are like, oh, he's making a kung fu movie that is going to have dubbing, and it's just going to be this silly thing. And it's like, no, like, Kill Bill is like this epic revenge story, you know, like, and people always take, like, they want that elevator pitch thing, and it's like, no, like, that's the thing you're going to recognize. But it really expands out into, like, a bigger deal. You know what I mean?
Well, that is a thing, but that's not what I was doing going into this.
No.
I knew this was a movie about movies, but it wasn't a good one. I just...
I'm not going to fight you on it. Like, it's
just, there's nothing going on here. I don't get it.
There is something going on, but you're right. There's the arcs aren't as big. It's more just a snapshot of a time and place that Tarantino is infatuated with.
Right. It's a set piece.
Yes. Yeah.
There was no point to go to the Playboy Mansion. I don't know why we saw Cliff, you know, fixing a roof antenna for like 15 minutes.
Well, if you count the flashback, we weren't watching him fix the antenna for 15 minutes.
The flashback within a flashback within a flashback?
What are you talking about?
Well, they flash back to the movie set, and then they flash back to him killing his wife, and then they flash back to the movie set.
The wife thing.
There's multiple flashbacks.
Which is also a nod to an actual thing when Natalie Wood drown under mysterious circumstances.
Right. See, I thought that was going to come back, and it was going to be like, if you finish the flashback, he didn't actually kill his wife or something. But no, I guess he did.
Someone, I have heard Tarantino wrote his own, like, novelization of this, which I've been wanting to read just out of curiosity. And apparently in the book, he does make it very clear that, yes, Cliff did kill his wife, like, which is just sort of like, again, makes him a, I'm not going to say this as like a good thing, but like, it makes him an interesting character to go like, oh, he's cool and he's funny and he's interesting and he's loyal. But he's also like really morally not all balanced. You know what I mean? Like,
he's a bad person.
He's been in and out of jail. He kind of alludes to that. And he resorts to violence pretty quick. And he's, you know, he's a very violent person, honestly.
Right.
When you break down all the scenes, when he beats, up Bruce Lee, and we have to talk about this because this is like become a controversial thing.
Oh boy.
It is, I think, the funniest scene in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know how you, I don't know where that came from, but it just, it's so, like, the dialogue, it's the most Tarantino thing in this movie. It's the most, like, the dialogue is right, and the comedy of it is right, and everything is more familiar. The rest of this doesn't feel like a Tarantino movie. It's not very quotable. The dialogue isn't clever and snappy the way a lot of his stuff usually is. It's just kind of a straightforward, like you said, a snapshot of something. Like, it's
like a slice of life.
Yeah. It's a very different kind of flavor of Tarantino movie.
I don't know. Maybe if... I don't know, but I like Slice of Life, so I don't know why I didn't like
this. I think this just didn't hit home with you for whatever
reason. I kept waiting for a reason for all of this to be happening or for anything. I thought when they finally went to... What was it? That ranch?
Spawn Ranch.
Yeah. I felt like that was almost the inciting incident of the movie, and I was like, oh, okay, we're picking up steam here. But then it went back down to nothing.
That scene is
and
great.
That was just a standalone.
Because I think that scene has the most tension in it.
It's the best part of the movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I want that to be the movie. I'm really disappointed that was over so quickly.
It's the way it ends with him just driving away is anticlimactic, kind of. You know, and when he goes back in the back and like Bruce Dern's like, oh no, I'm fine. Like,
right.
And it's...
They keep tension building just to be like, oh, never mind.
Kind of let it out in a weird way, but it's still like... I like the idea of... They ask him like, you saw George and he's all right. You know, we're not kidnapping him or... Are you satisfied we're not kidnapping him? And he's like, well, that's not the word I'd use, but yeah.
Still something
like,
shady.
He still knows, like, yeah, these weird hippies running around here, like, I don't know what this is all about. But, and I think it's great that it is Spawn Ranch, which is a real place.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where they shot, like, a ton of Westerns and stuff. And that is really where the Manson family, like, headquartered. And I like that they had this history of Cliff was like, yeah, I used to work. So he knows that place. He knows the vibe that should be going. And then he's just sort of like, oh, this is
He can tell
weird.
It's off.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. That stuff all connected really well for me. You're right. This movie is, like I said, it's not in my like top level of Quentin Tarantino movies. But I like the parts that I like, I really do like these Spawn Ranch, the fight at the end, the fight with Bruce Lee, the weird, I do even like the weird splicing of movie clips, like the 14 Fists of McCluskey. And then, he's like, hey, I heard you were almost in The Great Escape. And then they kind of put him into The Great Escape. It's like the Forrest Gump trick where they put Forrest Gump into like all the historical newsreels.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like that thing. And I'm like, this is cool. This is like cool, like Hollywood Easter egg shit. Sharon Tate goes to see that movie and that's actual Sharon Tate that she's watching on the screen. And I like that they did that they were like, yeah, we're not going to reshoot this with Margot Robbie. And apparently they talked to Sharon Tate's family and they were all like, yeah, show how great Sharon Tate was at being like a comedic actor and things like that.
That is the one thing of like, I feel like this movie is celebrating Sharon Tate.
I feel like this movie is celebrating Hollywood in this time period as a whole. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair. I feel like, I don't know, maybe she represents the hope or something, but like, I feel like I would appreciate that if I understood the story going into it. Like,
sure.
And like the ending, I feel like that's very wholesome, where they kind of show like she's alive and all is well.
Yeah.
And, this is,
and they invite him up to, you know, come hang out with us up at our, up at the house. And you know, and it is just sort of like it is more uplifting than the way the Manson family story actually ends. You know what I mean? And it's, you're right. I think in talking to you, it's made me realize that this is more insulated than not only any other Tarantino movie, as far as like needing to know things ahead of time, but it is that more than most, I would say more than most historical films. You know, most films will, like, walk you through what you need to know for the film. Like
they give you the basics.
You know, like I don't know very much about silent era Hollywood, but in watching Babylon, you get an idea of how things were working and operating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it may be, I'm sure, dramatized or condensed or something, but it's like, yeah, I'll bet somebody did die operating a camera in a little hot box. You know what I mean? Like, because of course you would have to isolate that. And they show you that, you know, here they kind of, it's like a walking tour of LA and like, hey, here's a Playboy Mansion, because the Playboy Mansion was the place to be. And they sort of show you that by who's there. But they don't really talk about why Playboy was sort of an important thing in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. With regards to, like, the sexual revolution. And there actually is, like, a lot of, like, empowerment of women and women's sexuality that Playboy championed by, you know, saying, don't be ashamed of your sexuality. These kind of things. Like, they don't, you're not going to get that. You're going to get what the modern view of Playboy is, which is, this is a misogynistic, terrible thing. But in the 60s, there was a whole different context to it. So when you're like, well, why would Michelle Williams and Mama Cass be hanging out, and Sharon Tate be hanging out at the Playboy Mansion? Because that was a cool place to be. They threw the best parties, and it was like where all the celebrities went.
I mean, I get that it was the big place to be, right. But like, I didn't know that.
There is a historical context to what that was at the time, as opposed to how it's largely seen now.
And that I can be like, okay, I go along with it. Like, sure, that's just a set piece.
It is a set piece. It's not important to the movie. I'm just, as an example.
I feel like if you're making a movie about a real life person, you kind of got to explain the basics, especially if this was 40 to 60 years ago, give or take.
I mean, it is 54 years ago, around that, yeah.
This is like a whole human lifetime, right, between then and now. Right. And so modern viewers aren't going to understand. Like, obviously, if you're making a film about Hitler, you don't have to explain what he did.
I mean, it's a little better known because it's world history.
Right.
Yes.
But I don't know who Charles Manson
is.
Sure. And I wanted to, I thought this movie would explain that to me. And like, such a disappointment.
I wonder if there was an assumption just based on the popularity of true crime
that people would just go and
know who Charles Manson was is.
I do think that last act of the movie reads very true crime when Cliff is doing the voiceover and explaining, all right, at 7:05, they went to the Mexican restaurant.
It's not Cliff, but it's Kurt Russell, who was the guy who hired him when he got in the fight with Bruce Lee, whose wife got her car smashed by Bruce Lee.
You're telling me that wasn't Brad Pitt's voice?
No, that's Kurt Russell's voice.
That was totally Brad Pitt's voice.
Look it up. It's Kurt Russell's voice.
What?
Yes, that's the guy.
Stuck out to me so much as just like weird formatting, because I was like, that's Cliff's voice. Why is Cliff narrating?
Voice. No.
Okay. Very similar. Yeah. Maybe they should have diversified the accent.
Great casting to put Kurt Russell in there in that role, not as a narrator, but as like the stunt coordinator, because he plays a character named Stuntman Mike in Death Proof, who murders people with his stunt car. Like, but...
Okay.
Yeah, I like that connection
there. I am really shocked. I swear that was Brad Pitt's voice.
No, that's Kurt Russell.
Okay. Well, anyway, like, he's he's going through the night. It's very true crime of them to, like, kind of lay out the scene of... And I'm sure all of that really did happen. And then, of course, it diverges.
There is a timeline for... Yeah. But a timeline of what, like, Sharon Tate and her friends and Jay Sebring were doing. You know, right. Like, oh, they went out for Mexican food And Sharon was crazy pregnant, and it was the hottest night of the year, and it was all of these things. Having Charles Manson show up at their house, and, you know, it's like, oh, I'm looking for Dennis Wilson, and they're like, he doesn't let you. Dennis Wilson was one of the Beach Boys, because Charles Manson used to hang out with the Beach Boys, and he was trying to get a record deal, and it's all of this stuff that you don't know anything about, so none of these lines make any sense to you. I get it. And this is like an insular movie in that way.
It's like a fan fiction for a book I haven't read, so I'm just like, huh?
Sure. It's hard to get your head around if you're not familiar with what the divergent history is. You know, you're seeing, like, the alternate history. You don't even know what the actual history is supposed to be.
I could kind of tell where it diverged in that car.
Right there. The snap decision to go murder Rick Dalton.
Let's go murder movie stars instead. Right. By the way, I was really shocked and happy when Maya Hawke showed up for, like, 5 seconds. She was the girl who was against the killings, or was just kind of like cowardly about it.
Was she one of the ones in the car?
She was. She was the one that spoke up and was like, what? And then the girl next to her was like, we should go murder the people that taught us to murder. But like, she was in Stranger Things, and
Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman, who's been in a ton of Tarantino movies,
right?
And they were romantically together for a while. That's not his daughter. But
I was like, ooh.
Dakota Fanning plays Squeaky Fromm, who answered the door. So Coraline in this movie. We've also seen Dakota Fanning in My Neighbor Totoro. She did the American voice of the older girl. And Elle Fanning is the younger girl.
The little girl, Totoro. Yeah.
I think Lena Dunham is in there. Austin Butler is Tex, the guy who played Elvis last year.
I was going to make a joke about Elvis being in this movie.
there's a lot of like small kind of cameos in this, which I think are cool to. And Tarantino does that with a lot of his sort of like walkthrough people in his other movie. Like Django Unchained has like a ton of people at Candyland at DiCaprio's ranch,
right?
Or just like the gunmen around, and a lot of them are like famous. They have no lines.
Just random parts,
And I think that's so cool.
Well, it's cool to have a lot of modern Hollywood stars play old Hollywood stars. In this.
And to have them, you know, be playing members of the Manson family, even some of the more famous ones like Squeaky Fromm, is it's cool to get someone like Dakota Fanning, who was a child star and kind of squeaky clean and adorable, and like, okay, we're gonna really like, you're gonna be like a filthy skanky hippie.
You're part of the Manson family.
And she just like leans in on it. It's like you gotta love that. It's just like, yeah, something totally different.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Talking about the ending, I think it became quite clear when they broke into that house. I was like, oh, this is a revenge fantasy. That's the whole point of anything for this movie, is to wind up here.
Sure.
And it was fun.
It's super fun.
It was a fun scene. I was like, okay.
I love how violent he takes. He's just sort of like escalating brutal violence until he literally comes out with a flamethrower, you know, Chekhov's flamethrower.
That's right.
And I mean, it's so over the top, but, I love the scene. I love Cliff on acid pointing his finger gun back at Austin Butler, who has an actual gun.
Are you here? Is this real?
Yes. I love the dog. I love the can of dog food in the face. Everything about the way that goes down is, I know it's not for everybody, but it's so brutal and over the top, I can't take it seriously. So for me, it's so much fun. It's just like when he, the first time I watch it and he launches that can of dog food and knocks her teeth out, I laughed so hard. I just, it was the only reaction I could have to that. And yeah, I love the breakdown of it. It's like, they destroyed the Manson family and saved Sharon Tate's life. And, you know, like, it's sort of like this happy ending on the Manson family. While still kind of oddly acknowledging it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like a, in the same way that we talked about with Inglourious Basterds, of like, it's an alternative history that doesn't, it's like clearly fake. Mm-hmm. And nobody's sitting here going, oh, this didn't happen. Like, right. or it was, it's just sort of like, wouldn't this have been great? Wouldn't this just have been a better ending to this horrific story?
I don't know if I've talked about this before on the podcast, but there's a mini series Hollywood where they kind of like it's a bunch of queer like black actors.
I don't remember
in
if you...
early Hollywood.
Yeah, go ahead, because I know you've talked to me about it. I don't remember if you've talked about it on the podcast.
Okay, but... well, like they essentially fight the Hays Code and get the movie they wanted to make made. And it portrays it, I felt like it was insensitive, because it was just like, oh, we could have done this, and then right. avoided all of this hardship. And it was so unrealistic, but sincere in a way that I was like, I don't think the maker of this really understood what was going on at the time,
right.
or what, this doesn't feel like that. This feels like, just kind of like fun, like...
Yeah.
Kind of like, this is what should have happened.
That's more like wish fulfillment to the detriment of people who actually struggled with that.
Yes.
And
this movie isn't like, oh, if Sharon Tate had done this, she would have protected herself.
Right.
And everything would have been fine. It's not blaming her. It's not like, oh, she should have taken this action instead. It's just... Wouldn't it have been great if they picked on the wrong people?
If they absolutely walked into the wrong house and, you know...
And just got annihilated.
And also having Sharon Tate set up as the red herring, if you know the Manson family mm-hmm. story, then the entire movie is acknowledging what actually happened. You know what I mean? Like, the mm-hmm. entire movie is leaning on your knowledge of it. So it's not like trying to say... Yeah, forget what happened. It's the whole movie is going, look, Sharon Tate, you know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it is saying, yes, this horrific event did take place and people were murdered. And this is just sort of like, there's an odd celebration of like Roman Polanski. Not odd. He was a shit hot director at the time.
They can't really not... acknowledge his future actions in
sure.
kind of this movie.
But it makes me wonder if this was like a sort of wish fulfillment aspect of this, is like Tarantino going, if his wife had lived, maybe he wouldn't have got in this other terrible controversy. And before anybody emails me the clip, yes, there is a clip of Tarantino defending Roman Polanski on the Howard Stern show like 25 years ago. It's not great. It's not a great clip. But I also think there were a few people who... There was a weird vibe about, like, oh, it happened a long time... You know, in, like, the 90s, when I first heard about it, because I didn't know who Roman Polanski was until I was 25.
I'm going to be real honest. I have no idea who he is or what the controversy is.
He directed Rosemary's Baby... Mm-hmm. He directed Chinatown, and the controversy is he slept with like a 12 or 13 year old girl.
Gotcha. Okay.
I say slept with.
I understand what that means.
The idea was like, oh, she was a willing participant. She didn't pursue charges after that. There was a lot of, you know, before people were actually talking about things like this. And I think she did write a book about like, I think like. You know, don't treat me like a victim, but yes, this happened. And I'm probably getting this wrong. She was not letting it slide either way. She was just sort of kind of talking about she didn't want to be seen as a victim, even though she was victimized as a child. It was sort of, you know, an accountability
well,
thing.
You don't want to that to become your only thing you're known for.
I think there's been a lot more conversation about it, and I'm not defending Tarantino's bad take on it. I'm just saying there were a lot of bad takes on it.
Yeah.
20 years ago. We have a, I think, much better discourse and discussion about that kind of thing now. It's why Roman Polanski doesn't come to the United States. It's why he lives in extradition-free countries, because he will be arrested for this thing, this terrible thing he did, you know?
I think, and
it makes me wonder if, like, part of this is Tarantino going, God, if Sharon Tate had lived, he wouldn't have been such a horrible fucking person. You know what I mean? And it's like, eh, I kind of think horrible people are horrible people.
I think if the guy defended him, that's probably not where he's coming from.
Yeah,
but
I don't know.
I think Quentin Tarantino kind of needs to shut his mouth a little bit sometimes.
He does. He is a fan of the sound of his own voice. And I, you know, I think he's had some hot takes. I think his ego, after his first couple movies, was on the verge of out of control. He was kind of insufferable to listen to. But I do enjoy hearing him talk about movies and movies that he's like passionate about and movies that he studied and movies that have influenced him. I think he's super knowledgeable about stuff like that.
Well, that's like anyone with a special interest is like, oh, they can tell you everything about everything.
I think Tarantino's somewhere on the spectrum and just like he's super focused on cinema and actually is able to create it as well. You know, like,
I get it. And I think he's good at what he does. I just think sometimes he's like, okay,
yeah,
let's back up.
Yeah,
there,
I can only listen to him for so long.
Put a foot in it.
all right. Do we want to talk about the elephant's foot in the room?
I think there's enough of them on screen that we can. I do like what you said during the movie when I pointed it out.
I think he's been memed to a point where he's like, oh, you think I like feet, huh? Okay. And now he's just going to shove feet in your face at every opportunity.
I think you're right about that, because this movie is so not
it's
subtle
so
about it.
Yes.
It's, I mean, hippies having dirty feet is one thing, you know, but you get a shot in the dumpster. You get a shot of Sharon Tate's feet for like 5 whole minutes.
Oh, yeah.
You get, you know, in the car, again, there's more feet up on the dashboard.
Feet. Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my gosh, please get it off the screen.
There is a lot of feet.
I need a windshield wiper to just take it away.
Take it away. Yeah. I mean,
but honestly, it's pretty funny that he incorporated it on purpose just to be like, well, fuck you guys.
I saw an Instagram reel of a fan. And she went up to him and asked him to sign his foot. And he was super cool. He was like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, like, and he took out a Sharpie, and it's probably the best minute of his day. But
it's like, play a calm.
All right, Quentin.
There's cameras.
Oh my God, it's just like my dream. Yeah, like, but that is the thing I like about Tarantino, is if you, every video, every interaction I see of somebody who genuinely is a fan of his and approaches him and is friendly, he is really cool with. People who approach him with like shit heel questions, trying to like gotcha, you know, like reporters or people who want to troll him or something like that, he's fucking nasty. But I like his real fans who go up to him. I will say, like, Tarantino, he seems like a cool guy. Like, if you went up to him, you're like, hey man, I love Jackie Brown, I love that you adapted Elmore Leonard. This is my rehearsed line if I ever meet him.
Oh, okay.
I'd be like,
I
saw Jackie Brown in a art house theater. It was a great experience. I love it. I feel like he would be like, all right, man, I love that you love Jackie Brown or something like that. Like, and then we'd be best friends and hang out all the time.
I want to be like,
that probably wouldn't happen, but
and then we made a movie together.
You put me in this last movie.
I kind of want to be like, oh, well, you know, as long as you have something nice to say about him, he'll be good to you. But, like, that is kind of celebrities. Like,
I think that's everybody.
You can't just come up to them and be like, why'd you do this in this movie? That was stupid. Like, even if you like all of his other work,
right.
He's not going to know that. He's just, you can't come up to someone. It's like the paparazzi. It's like an invasion.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
I think that's so everybody, I think though. That's if somebody comes to you online and is like cool with you, like I'll talk to anybody online, but
right.
You come up and try and like troll me about something, I'm gonna just probably either troll you back or block you, depending on my mood that day.
It's not worth it.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, him signing that foot is pretty great.
It's pretty funny.
Did you like the soundtrack of this movie, at least?
I didn't notice it that much.
Yeah.
Like, it was there. I was like, okay, this is 60s, 70s vibes.
Yeah, it's like 60s pop.
But, you know, that's...
I like that it was almost all through the radio. They'd get in the car and turn it on, and it was like...
We've got the record player.
Very, like, Reservoir Dogs in that way, where, like, the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack is all... It's like... programming for the radio.
It's in universe kind of.
Yeah, and they even have like the DJ.
Oh, okay.
Like it's Steven Wright, it's great. But yeah, like I thought the soundtrack was really fun, and I loved the way they did it with like the car radios, because so much of this movie is like in cars.
I guess that speaks to how immersive it was that I like didn't notice. I was just like, okay, we're listening to this funky tune now. I don't know.
I don't know. I just something I did notice.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. It's like scores. Like, I don't know the scores a lot.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, well, that means the score was good, right? Like,
that's
kind of what it's supposed to do, is just set a mood without you noticing.
Elevates the tone.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about the Bruce Lee scene before we get too far away from it.
You said there was controversy. What?
There was controversy. It has been seen as racist, because he's the, you know, only Asian character in this movie. Almost the only non-white person in this movie. It's very white for a Tarantino movie. And he gets beat up, basically. And also, Bruce Lee's daughter has gone on record as saying, like, you know, this is disrespectful to Bruce Lee and his legacy and things like that.
I'm going to stop you right there and say, I didn't notice that at all. So I feel like that's coming at it looking for racist intent, which in itself I feel like is kind of racist.
I agree with you. I feel like his daughter being opposed to it is something personal.
Right. I get that.
I think if you know Tarantino's filmography, and this is also, he caught shit for like, not caught shit, somebody asked him about like, how come Margot Robbie doesn't have more lines? I don't know if you've ever seen that. He's like on a panel.
Oh no.
And he just says, I reject your hypothesis or something like that. He just refuses to answer her. People who think Tarantino is a misogynist or racist have not paid attention to his movies. I think he has done more. He is... created more empowering roles for women and people of color than probably any modern era white filmmaker. I mean, just across the board, Asians, black people, women have always had prominent, badass, empowering roles in his movies. And I just think that's I think it's kind of crazy to come at it. But I also kind of have an idea. Excuse me. I also kind of have a view of this scene. If you want to put a racial lens on it, you can look at this scene as this is what white Hollywood did to Bruce Lee in real life. Not physically beat him up, but metaphorically.
Right.
He was on the Green Hornet, which is where, like, the set this scene takes place on, playing Kato. And around that time, Bruce Lee wanted to make the show Kung Fu and pitched it to the studios. And they either passed and made it anyway. Somehow it got taken away from him, and they cast a white guy in it. They cast the Robert Carradine, who's in Kill Bill. but it is like Bruce Lee got the shaft from Hollywood for a long time, and he wasn't famous until Enter the Dragon, which came out in the United States, I think, after he was dead. Like, Hollywood didn't really care about Bruce Lee. He was kind of a novelty. Everyone agreed he was like a total badass, but they were like, he's pretty Asian. I don't know if we want to put him on you know, right. primetime TV. And like, they made him wear the mask on Green Hornet. And
that's kind of messed up.
There was the scene in, and it's a biopic about Bruce Lee that came out when I was in high school. And there was like specifically a scene where they were like, yeah, we need the eye holes made so he doesn't look so eight. Like they tried to make him look less Asian, you know, like, I think Hollywood screwed Bruce Lee over big time.
I believe that for sure.
And so if you want to put a racial lens on a white guy beating the shit out of Bruce Lee, I think you can use that as a metaphor for this is what Hollywood did to Bruce Lee. He could have been an enormous star in his lifetime, kind of if they had allowed him to be.
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
I kind of just read that scene as like, oh, actors think they know what they're talking about, whatever, but here's an actual badass and he's just going to just kind of wish fulfillment. But
it was, yeah, it was.
I didn't read it as offensive or just kind of like.
I think it really just served to show like, Cliff is kind of a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. And you know, his career is on the rocks too because of stuff like this. And also that like Cliff is not only like violent, but like he's a good fighter, that he was able to fight and hold his own with Bruce Lee.
He can kind of back it up.
Like,
yeah.
He's fighting Bruce Lee and they go, he's beating the shit out of Bruce. And I do like that they show Bruce Lee as kind of conceited.
I wouldn't say he beat me up.
Hold on. No one beat the shit out of Bruce. But that they also showed Bruce Lee like training Sharon Tate when she was watching the movie, and they would like flash back to
That was cool.
Her, because Bruce Lee did train a lot of Hollywood actors. He was like the first, he popularized martial arts in the U.S. and I think was one of the first people to teach it in the U.S. And he even trained B-movie star and internet punchline Chuck Norris. Yeah,
very nice.
So I like the Bruce Lee scene because I feel, and I like that he's in this movie with those quick little training flashbacks, because I feel like it is like a fun homage to Bruce Lee and what he was. And it's, you know, it's not a full picture of who he was, but Bruce Lee was a pretty fascinating guy.
And it is a bit of a cartoon version of him. But which, again, isn't a bad thing.
Everyone's kind of a cartoon in this. So yeah. It all kind of fits. Cliff, I think, is the last thing. I think putting Cliff in here, up against the hippies. And they all, like, hate the hippies, you know? But I think he's really fascinating. I love that he's, like, he's Rick's hype man, you know? He's like, oh, come on, you know? He's like, you're Rick fucking Dalton, you know, these kind of things. He's kind of like his protector. He's like, oh, take my sunglasses when he's crying.
Right, he's everything.
He's, like, looking out for him. But I also love that Cliff is zen, is what I have written down. Cliff is just, like, there. He doesn't care about much. He lives this kind of simple life in this shitty trailer, but he doesn't care about
it. He's not mad about it.
Yeah. He's just sort of like, I got a good life with my dog out here and, you know, comic books and drinking beer. It's pretty good.
I mean, it's kind of like he killed off his his
yeah
his worries his kind I of, mean his nagging wife was a very bit. Much
kind of victim blaming yeah. Ross, but
sorry
she did look very difficult.
Natalie Wood, I would like to apologize.
He's got this good life, and I like that he's this kind of zen character, and the hippies who are supposed to be looking for that, like, aren't that.
They're hopped up on drugs, and they're just like, you know, they're crazy.
They're taking the LSD that is supposed to expand your mind and get you there, but they're just getting more and more deranged out there, mm-hmm. and like the idea of putting him against the hippies, and it's like, oh, all this thing they're searching really hard for, he just is that. And I love the juxtaposition of that, and his attitude is just so chill.
I hadn't considered that. That's a pretty cool level to that.
It's the multi levels of him. He's just so kind of go with the flow. He doesn't care when Rick fires him, you know, mm-hmm. or lays him off. He doesn't, you know.
I mean, he cares as a friend, but he's not angry about
it.
I did think in the setup of this movie, this first act, I kind of thought the way that he's kind of taken advantage of, that I was like, oh, this is going to be a revenge story of, like, he's going to get fed up with being the stunt double, and he's gonna murder him or something. Like, something really dark like that. But then, quickly, I was like, no, okay, he's cool with it.
No,
he's
it chill. Is. Like, he just loves his life as a stuntman, and just mm-hmm. kind of hanging out with this actor. You know, it's like, oh, I like house sitting for you up in the hills when you're out of town. Like, he's just sort of like, he's got a good situation going on, just hanging out with his friend, basically.
I do like that scene where he's driving him home and he's complaining about his career, blah, blah, blah. He's all mopey. And then they get there and, I can't remember, but he's like, anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. I'm going to work. And Cliff goes, oh, so you're all right now? And he goes, peachy, like, whatever. He's like, he's totally forgotten about it. Or he's at least put his walls back up, and
he's ready to, you know, push forward with whatever he's got to do.
There's something charming about that friendship between them.
There is. There's like a camaraderie. And I even like the lead up to that part that you're talking about is, you know, he's like, oh, they want me to do Italian Westerns. And he's like, he's basically like, you know, making movies in Italy doesn't sound that bad. Like, he's just kind of like,
gig.
Yeah, you get to keep working. You're making movies. You're living in Rome. And, mm-hmm. and you know, he's like, you ever seen an Italian Western? They're terrible. And he's just like, you know.
You say this movie doesn't have Tarantino's quippy dialogue, but
I mean,
it's got little
aspects of it, but yeah.
The line, don't cry in front of the Mexicans. Killed me. I just, really, really funny.
Well, that and the Italian Western he ended up making, that was like, even the title was like horribly racist against Native Americans. Well,
that's kind adapted, of a commentary on the time.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. They're adapted from the book. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. I mean, it's just like, just blatantly like, yeah.
Which, I'm pretty sure that's a line from one of the U.S. presidents.
Oh, probably Andrew Jackson.
That's a literal quote.
Not surprising.
Not searching far in history for that, you know.
And just, that was the kind of...
It was a real attitude back then.
And I love the posters that they made for those, like, fake Italian movies.
Yeah, they look cool.
They look exactly like what those like, Sergio Leone posters look like.
And wasn't one of them, like, a knockoff of a different one, like...
I
can't remember.
There was one that was like a knockoff James Bond. It was like the Italian Bond thing. And then they show like the car jumping, and they freeze frame the like, Cliff. He's doing the stunt double in Italy too. I did like that. I love that aspect of like the Clint Eastwood parallel of doing the spaghetti Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because spaghetti Westerns are crazy fun. But I think probably at the time, there were probably a lot of actors who were like, no, I'm not going to go do these weird foreign movies where...
Snobbish.
Everybody's speaking a different language, and then it's... The dubbing is... I mean, there's a ton of bad ones, for sure, but, like, the stuff that actually made it to the States and became mainstream, I mean, are some incredible movies, so...
It's pretty cool.
It is cool. And Morricone, who scored things like the Man With No Name trilogy in Italy, did those Clint Eastwood movies, he scored The Hateful Eight.
Oh.
For Tarantino.
Okay.
So...
You can tell Tarantino likes Westerns, and he likes spaghetti Westerns, and like...
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, he's made so many
He's made two really... I love his Western movie. I love Django and The Hateful Eight both. But you can tell he has a real love for that, even in this movie, just by virtue of having Rick Dalton go make... spaghetti Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of, like, I think he made sure to point out, like, what the production process was like, how it was fast and, you know, run and gun kind of stuff, whereas, like, he ends up making, like, four movies in 6 months.
Yeah, and it's breakneck pace because that's just how it was.
Talking about, like, the way everybody, all the actors spoke their native languages and they just dubbed it all later. Like, he mentions this in the movie. Like, he doesn't bring you up to speed on the Manson family or the historical context of L.A. landmarks, but he does want you to know how they made spaghetti Westerns because, like, that's just the biggest movie nerd.
That's his priority here, is... I can't really fault him for that. That's the thing, is this movie brings up a lot of interesting stuff. There's a lot of interesting things happening. I just wish it had a plot. I really do.
It's one of those movies that's almost just like, there's a vibe to this movie. And it's kind of fun. Just to put on. And there's a few set pieces that really draw me in.
I probably would have enjoyed it more if I just chilled with the vibe, but I was searching so hard for, what's the point here?
Sure. It does, I talked about Babylon kind of meandering and being unfocused.
Mm.
And I think this movie has a similar problem. Like, it's very, very, like, laser-focused in certain scenes on what's happening in that scene. But the big overarching plot, it just wanders, you know? It just kind of... we're going to go over here now. Now we're going to watch Rick on set. We're going to watch Rick get drunk in his pool while he's running lines, you know, and stuff like that. I think there is a similar problem, and I'm not throwing that at you like, well, you like Babylon, you should like this.
No.
I think, cause that was my real criticism of Babylon too. So I'm not going to fault you for having a similar, criticism here. I also think you bring up a really good point that Rick Dalton and, I forget Brad Pitt's character in Babylon.
I don't know.
But they're facing similar things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't sympathize with Rick in the same way that I sympathize with Pitt in Babylon. I feel he's a more sympathetic character, partly because I think there is an idea in this movie that when the 70s come and the new Hollywood takes over and a different kind of movie takes off, that he'll find his niche in there. That Rick Dalton, right. You know, like it's...
He's waiting for that.
A thing I thought of later that I should have chose instead of this movie as a pairing... was Inside Llewyn Davis, because that's a movie about a folk singer who kind of exists out of time. He kind of exists in a time when folk is really niche and it's hard to sell. And he's struggling and trying to get a break. And then at the end, they show Bob Dylan in the club. And it's just sort of like, oh, this is where folk takes off. And it's just sort of like, you're left kind of going, did he miss the boat, or is he going to, is it going to
Is this his big opportunity?
Right.
Yeah.
Great Coen Brothers movie.
It's very similar to this.
Uh, Yes, there's a similar ending to that. That movie is a little more focused on a single person, though, as opposed to a place in time, and sort of an overarching, like Babylon being so epic and spanning right. like 10 years or whatever it did. But yeah, that's all I got for this. You got any closing thoughts?
I know I've been hard on this movie, but I don't want to, I don't want to be like, this was a bad pick, because I don't think that's the case. Like, I think it matches up well with Babylon. There's a lot of similarities.
Let's talk about it as a double feature, because, because I largely paired this up because it had Brad Pitt, it had Margot Robbie. It was mm-hmm. a period piece. It was about the end of an era. And they both have a scene of Margot Robbie going to see a movie that she is in and trying to convince the person in the box office that it's her.
Yeah.
When I saw that in Babylon, I'm like, holy shit. This is the same fucking scene.
Like, and yeah. I think these movies came out at a similar time because, I don't know, Babylon was more recent. Maybe there's a few years difference, but
a couple. This was 2019.
Okay.
And Babylon was last year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there was some time between, but
sure.
I totally thought the line. Brad Pitt says a line in Babylon of like, before I came to Hollywood, there was a sign that said no dogs and no actors allowed, and I changed that. I thought that was a line from this movie before I saw either of these movies. So
there is a line in The Hateful Eight that says, there used to be a sign hanging up there that said no dogs and no Mexicans allowed. And he said, then they took it down and they started allowing dogs in. it was talking about the boarding house or whatever, and how racist the woman who ran it was. But, yeah, that's really strange. And Bruce Dern was, Bruce Dern was in that. Bruce Dern, I don't know if you know this, is Laura Dern's father.
Okay, who is he in this?
He's the old man. He's George Spahn from the Spahn Ranch. The old man who was in the back.
Okay,
that Brad Pitt went to see. Yeah,
huh. And Laura Dern we saw in what is it? Marriage Story.
That's right. She's in Marriage Story. She is in Marriage Story. That's right. We have seen her.
Fun little connection
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that is. But yeah, it was really just like surface level elements that I chose for this. But I thought the period piece of Hollywood, seeing Hollywood in the 20s, seeing Hollywood in the 30s, and then seeing Hollywood in the late 60s, it's very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
But also very, very period. I loved the production design of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, of capturing that time period of the late 60s.
I think it's a beautiful movie.
It's amazing looking, and I don't know how he rebuilt that. I don't know how much of it is CGI. I don't know if he built sets. I don't know if he put new facades on buildings. The big Kentucky Fried Chicken, they used to have like the bucket of chicken at the top, and all those old theaters. It just looked amazing.
They drive past like walls with ads on them, yes, like posters,
the big billboards, and it's great. It looks so amazing, and Babylon had some great. I mean, it's totally like Art Deco, like way further back.
Yeah,
but also the on set segments of Babylon, I thought were super interesting. And in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, were also great when they're like rolling a whole like backdrop away, mm-hmm. and it opens up like the whole back lot. It's just, I love stuff like that. I think that it's really cool, and I think in that way these paired up pretty good.
And of course the tale as old as time, an actor who was in their heyday and now is no longer, or is chasing that goal.
Right.
You know, that's. That's always going to be Hollywood, no matter what year you're in. That's just...
It does.
That's the LA like, story.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, that was The Artist a few years ago. The silent movie they made is about the end of the silent era. It's always about, like, the end of an era, and can I make the leap into something else? But, yeah, I don't know. I think it fit pretty good.
It does, yeah.
At the end of the day, I think... Man, I really like a few parts of this movie, but I think on the whole, Babylon is probably a better movie than this. So I don't know what order to put them in.
Well, either way,
it's really heavy to watch Babylon second on the, you know, after a 3-hour movie, and then I just want to get it out of the way, and then it's like the more fun one afterwards.
I think either way you split it. Watching these as a double feature is going to take 9 hours out of your day.
It's a big.
These are both long movies. Yeah. I would put this one second because I do think it's got a lighter tone, and I think Babylon is so intense that I think this slice of life, casual, just kind of sit back and watch Hollywood be Hollywood. I feel like that would go really well after seeing Babylon.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good call. Can you think, what did you have any other ideas about what would have paired with Babylon?
That's a tough one. I was like, I'll let you come up with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's movies about movies.
Right.
But, I wasn't sure. After I picked this, I did think, like, oh, Tropic Thunder would have been fun. Because that's sort of a parody of all Hollywood. You know, like, there's parody of Oscar bait movies and stuff like that in there. Agents.
I think another Paul Thomas Anderson. Not that he didn't make Babylon, but I feel like his movies are similar to that, like, similar to the vibe.
I mentioned last week, Boogie Nights. I think Boogie Nights would have actually been a really, I love that movie, and it's super fun. And I think we would have gotten a lot of the same thing, but it's, like I said, it's almost the same movie.
Right.
Inside Llewyn Davis, I think, would have been a good one. And I also think it might have been kind of cool to choose, like, a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Oh, that would be
And actually
fun.
Watch, like, a silent movie from that era.
I've seen a few of, like, the short movies, mm-hmm. but I don't think I've ever seen, like, a full-length...
I've seen a couple. They're fun, and they're... some of them are surprisingly touching and emotional. Like, you know, if you can get that across without sound, that's pretty good.
It's pretty hard to do. I'm trying to think of... There's a movie, Nightcrawler.
Oh yeah,
of like the ambulance chasing kind of unethical journalism. I feel like
that movie's really great. Actually, I think Nightcrawler is great.
I don't think it's a perfect parallel with Babylon, but that tone I feel like is similar.
There is sort of a darkness to Babylon that I think would
There's a real darkness,
over.
Yeah.
Well, I think you'd get to the end of that double feature and be like, oh God. Like,
turn on some Teletubbies or something.
You're just an absolute nihilist at the end of it. Like, nothing matters.
What's the point?
Yeah, that'd be a rough one, man. But cool.
Yeah.
We have one more double feature to go for this season.
Yes, we do. Right. I'm excited to see what's going to close out our season.
Yeah. Can't wait to find out. Ooh. Oh, wait, that's me, isn't it?
It is your job.
All right. We'll get on that. For now though, what do you got for shout outs?
For shout outs, I found a cool video talking about, kind of the history of the man who painted Obama's official portrait, which I've always really liked that painting just because I find a lot of, not, this isn't like a key interest of mine. I just found this video interesting because it's diving into who he picked to paint his portrait. and it really broke a lot of traditions.
Yeah, they had to use colors they've never used for a presidential portrait before.
Well, true, but, you know, if you look at the historic portraits of the past, like, they're all very, like, president with paper, president with books, president with a feather. Like, just very formal, very formulaic, and, you know, he was a groundbreaking president in a lot of ways, and so he... It shows that he put a lot of thought into who he picked to create this art piece.
Sure.
And I really do think that painting is beautiful. It's got all the flowers and colors, and it's just a very vibrant portrait that I think is really cool.
Is he wearing the brown suit? The tan suit?
It's just him on a talk show, the tan suit. That would be great, but no. So yeah, I just think that video was a fun thing to learn about, so...
Cool.
Check it out. What do you got, Dad?
I will check that out. I have, I know I've shouted out last podcast on the left before. They did a great series on the Manson family, 2015.
So it's I can finally learn about what I thought this movie would teach me.
Look, I'm not a true crime guy. I think last podcast does a great job of making it fun and entertaining. And not, like, being dicks to the victims about it. Like, when they make a lot of jokes, but it's always at, like, the perpetrator's expense. Because most of the time, they're really
These guys are losers.
And they do talk about, really, how the Manson family... Charles Manson wasn't some weird mastermind. He was a drugged-out weirdo, you know? And everybody out there was a bunch of drugged-out, naked weirdos who were just... They burned out their brains on acid, you know?
Like, yeah.
And, but yeah, it's, I think it's a really great series that goes, gives a lot of great information about the Manson family, who they were, what they were all about, and kind of their history. Charles Manson's history is like a failed artist, basically.
Mm.
Who just went off the deep end, kind of. It's a theme throughout history of failed artists.
Failed artists,
And how they react to.
And Quentin Tarantino has made a movie about two of them.
That's me. Wow. That's, I wonder who's next.
Good thing he's good at making movies, right, guys? Yeah, that's true. His career had failed. Yikes.
Go ahead.
I do really like the idea of challenging that notion of, you know... bad people, serial killers, as being like cunning masterminds, the Joker. Yeah. Like, no, these are just dumb,
most
sick
of the time,
people.
They're really like dumb people. And you know, they talked about the Dahmer case on last podcast. And I know I haven't watched the documentary or the series that came out about it,
but people but, like, love to romanticize
there,
it.
There's a lot of that one happened when I was in high school, and I didn't grow up in Milwaukee, but it was in the Midwest. Milwaukee wasn't far from us, so it was like
still
like,
uneasy.
Oh, this is weird. This is like really close to us, and it was you know, to find. So I did listen to that one, and there was a lot of information about like. Oh, yeah. Cops basically enabled him. He got away with that for a long time because cops were weirded out by gay shit. And, you know, like, it just... I found out a couple of years ago, those cops stayed on the force.
Yeah.
Like, those cops, got medals a couple years ago. And people were like, wait a minute, these were the same cops who let Jeffrey Dahmer kill all those people. Like, it's like, you never fired those guys? And they're like, yeah, no, we didn't. It's just like, oh my God.
A lot's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah. Much better accountability now. I'm rolling my eyes.
Make sure they see this.
Yeah.
Because this is an audio only.
I forgot this is audio only. Anyway, yeah, I like last podcast, and I'm not a true crime guy. So, you know,
all right.
Take that as you will. Give it a shot. On that note, we want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility It helps us grow the show.
That's right. Another way to help us grow the show is to tell a friend. You and that friend can kick your feet back right in front of the screen, lean back, and smoke your acid cigarette while listen to our show. And that'll make us so much more funnier. No.
Probably won't hurt.
But yeah, that's our show. What are we doing next week?
Next week. Man, I really fought with this, but I wanted to bring something that I know I'm a fan of and that I'm pretty sure you're a fan of.
Okay.
I wanted to redeem myself. I wanted us to have a good time with this. I'm bringing, it's at the very least in contention for my favorite movie of last year. We're going to watch Jordan Peele's Nope.
Ooh. Okay.
I love Nope. I had a great time with that. It was the last movie I watched last year. Finish it up right before midnight on New Year's Eve. That's the way I rock New Year's Eve. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to watching it again and talking about it here. Getting back to some Jordan Peele. We haven't watched one of his movies since season one.
Yeah.
So
really interesting. I'm looking forward to that.
So am I. I think we'll have a really good time with that.
And I'm already thinking about what to pair it with. There's nothing. That's going to be a tricky one. I'll find something.
Yeah, there's so many possibilities. It goes so many different ways. But, yeah.
Looking forward to
Nope.
That.
Nope. Please join exciting. Us for a discussion of Nope. Us. Why don't you tell everyone how they can get a hold of us?
Well, people can email us at austinandphil@gmail.com. And did we go over our bit of fan mail?
We got a letter this week. I say letter as though the Pony Express delivered
That's right. Paid a lot of stamp postage for that.
Friend of the show and former guest, Amy Frost, sent us a book recommendation based on our Babylon episode.
That's right. She recommended and noted a lot of similarities between the book The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. That's a book by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Yep.
And I really like this comparison that she gives between these two.
Yeah, I do too. She talks about the plot of this movie dealing a lot with the golden age of Hollywood and the queer people who had to navigate the weird morality and landscape of that, which sounds really, really interesting.
It does. And I have heard of this book. I think it kind of blew up on like Book Talk and YouTube, but like rightfully so. And now I kind of want to check it out even more, knowing that it explores all of that.
I have some Audible credits and just running off of this period piece Hollywood double feature. I might download this and just listen to it at work.
Go for it. That would be fun.
But yeah, it's I love that Amy gave us a recommendation based on what we were talking about, and I really want to encourage anybody else, if it doesn't have to be another movie, it can be a TV show or a book like Amy did, a comic, anything that kind of rides the coattails of a movie we're talking about that we can share with our audience. And, you know, if you're a fan of Babylon, it sounds like you would probably enjoy this this book as well.
I think it's always fun to start a conversation around, you know, similar media and stuff. So I love it when people join in our conversation and do that. So again, you can do that at austinandphil@gmail.com. Where else can people find what we're watching?
Letterboxd. Austin, you are Austin N. Rude, and I am Phil Rude on Letterboxd. And there you can see us keeping track of lists of what we're watching. I have a list on my profile of what we watch for the show. I leave ratings for most things I watch. I don't know. It's Letterboxd.
Right.
Come see what we're watching.
Most of the reviews I post are memes, but if you want to hear what my thoughts on the Mario movie were, you can check it out there.
I need to check that out. All right. the greatest cinematic masterpiece of our time.
Sure.
I just reviewed, I just rewatched The Road Warrior the other night.
Oh, yeah?
And I left my review on there, and I went and scrolled the reviews, and there's some gold in the Road Warrior reviews.
I love the funny reviews. They're the best.
One guy was like, said, this movie illustrates how when society collapses and there are no rules, we'll all dress gay. I think Ben Shapiro maybe says it a little better, but this movie shows it for you. Like, it's really great. Go down the rabbit hole of reviews. Pretty great.
I did read a Babylon review. Someone said this is the best Avatar movie because there's like 2 seconds of the movie Avatar in that sequence.
Yeah, there is at the end. That's great. Well, anyway, that's Letterboxd, and that's it for us today. We've taken up enough of your time. Austin, do you want to read the credits?
Yeah, we did it all ourselves.
There you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.